Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, and I am a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center and a contributor to the Bulwark. And I'm joined from sunny, I hope, España by my partner in all things strategy, grand and not so grand, Elliot Cohen, who is Professor Emeritus of Strategy at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies and a contributing writer for the Atlantic. Elliot, how is Spain?
After a while, the unremitting sunshine, the temperature at about 60, the thick hot chocolate, the sherry, the oranges, it wears on you after a while.
I can imagine.
By the way, how's the weather where you are?
It's actually sunny right now, although we're about to enter into several days of possible snowstorms. So, I will be thinking of you and the sun and, sipping Tempranillo and trying not to feel too jealous.
Well, actually, we're flying back into that, so I hope we'll be able to make it. So plenty of stuff to discuss. Eric, as usual, I will be faintly less pessimistic than you are, but that's a really low bar. So why don't you just start with your dark visions of how the world is getting, just really about to go off the cliff.
I think that, we're in a very dangerous place right now. But you had a piece in the Atlantic I wanted to start us off on, which basically said, look, all these people like me have been comparing Trump to various authoritarians around the world, whether it's Putin, whether it's Viktor Orban, or my personal favorite, Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey. Your point was that Trump is a very American phenomenon, and there are plenty of antecedents in America for Trump, Andrew Jackson, Father Coughlin, various demagogues in the turn of the century South in the United States, which I spent some of my misspent youth as a graduate student actually studying. Joseph McCarthy. And I certainly agree with the latter in particular. I think there is a lot of McCarthyism in Trumpism. And there's also kind of a genealogical element there, because of course McCarthy's amanuensis Roy Cohen was also sort of Trump's consigliere early in his career as a New York real estate developer. So I'm happy to concede the point that there are plenty of American antecedents. I guess what I would just say is, though, I think that we should bear in mind that while that is certainly true, some of these comparisons to, European autocrats are, also still important to keep in mind, in part because some of these people, like Vice President Vance, have, spoken about their enormous admiration for Viktor Orban. Vance was just quoting Harvard law professor Adam Vermeule, who was tweeting about why we should disregard the decisions of judges. Vermeule, like Vance, wants a kind of Catholic theocracy. There's some other antecedents there. The neo-reactionary movement that Curtis Yarvin has written about. A lot of that is rooted in this sort of kind of weird anarcho-fascist phenomenon, with Murray Rothbard writing about his admiration for Mussolini. There are just a lot of elements there. And just over the weekend, you know, the fact that President Trump stripped Mark Zaid, who's a lawyer, does national security work in D.C. on security clearances. You know, a lot of our former students have used his services and when dealing with some complicated, you know, clearance issues, had his clearance stripped because he's been suing the Trump administration. And watching him go after lawyers, that's a very, you know, Putin-like step. So anyway, I just see, you know, elements of both here.
So in what I suspect is going to be a series of attempts by me to explain myself, let me push that. On the one hand, I think there is some commonality with things that are happening elsewhere in the West, which is a general kind of revulsion against, let's call them, liberal elites. But most broadly, I would say, you know, what is our task now? Obviously, if there are particular things that we think are bad that we can fight, we should fight them. But I think the task for intellectuals is first figure out, well, how did we get here? Why is it that we're in the circumstance that we're in? And I really don't think comparisons with Mussolini or Viktor Orban or any of these people is of any use whatsoever. I mean, there has been a particular, I think, kind of cultural evolution in the United States. There's a particular history in the United States. I think certainly as a way of thinking about our future, it's crazy because you're dealing with countries that are completely different histories in the United States. You know, you begin talking about Weimar Germany or even, you know, Orban's Hungary, places, you know, Hungary traumatized by 50 years under the Russian boot, Weimar Germany having gone through World War I, Turkey having always had this large conservative religious population that rebelled against the hyper-secularism of Ataturk. None of these analogies are helpful in understanding why we are where we are, which I think is really the first thing that is of importance. And I think the smartest Democrats understand that. As I said, I concede that there are some elements of commonality here in what are the underlying phenomena. But I think there's, as I point out in the article, there's some very big differences between what the Trump people are trying to do and what you see other autocrats doing. One is, although on the one hand, you're quite right, Trump wants to expand executive power in ways that are illegitimate and dangerous. On the whole, the enterprise is an attempt to destroy the government. It's not to make it stronger. It is, you know, to dismantle agencies, not to create them. And I think that's actually quite significant. I point to some other very, to my mind, very substantial differences. I also think that, although I agree with you, we're in a dangerous time. You know, sooner in some ways than I expected, we're going to begin to see whether the guardrails will hold, particularly if they decide simply to disregard court orders. Now that, it seems to me, a lot of the things we're talking about, ending birthright citizenship, or even deciding, you know, trying to decide that the federal government, that the executive branch can decide not to spend money that Congress has appropriated, that's going to end up at the Supreme Court, I think, all of those. And we'll see. I actually think it's a mistake to think that the Supreme Court will go along with that. You know, I mean, as I point out in the article, the justices who have been most Trumpy, if that's a word, have been Alito, and to some extent, Clarence Thomas. I don't think the others are going to go along with that. And I also think that, the fact is, this is a 50-50 kind of election, although Trump is to some extent popular because people like the idea of not spending money on foreign aid and, you know, taking down DEI and stuff like that. I don't think that a lot of what they're doing is very popular, and it's not going to be popular. You know, you stop spending money, you know, farmers are getting upset. Tariffs are not going to do any good whatsoever for their own people. So I just think, you know, the laws of gravity are going to operate. That's not, I'm not trying to downplay the dangers, because I think the dangers are real. But I do think that we make a mistake first by really whipping ourselves into a frenzy, because they like that, among other things. But I also think, just in terms of diagnosis and long-term repair to the system, you know, what we need to do is we need to look, as I say at the end of the article, we need to look at ourselves in the mirror rather than look out the window. And in a certain way, I have to say, I feel that the analogies to the Orbans and the, let alone to the Mussolinis, and then, you know, the argument ad Hitlerum is always a sign that you've run out of arguments. It's actually an excuse for inaction, because you say, oh my God, all is lost. There's nothing we can do. It's terrible. And, okay, all you're left with is reaching for the cyanide pills, as opposed to saying, no, maybe actually some things that we did help lead to this situation, and maybe there are concrete things we can do to help fix it. I mean, there's, I you know, as I think I said very early on after the election, if there's one thing that I think is a mistake right now, it's for people who are as opposed to this administration as you and I are, is to get hysterical. It's counterproductive, and it just makes them happy.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, look, I agree with a lot of what you said. First of all, but there are some areas that I think I have some minor disagreements. I agree that, you know, we need to look at, you know, the United States to understand this phenomenon. And as I said, the McCarthy phenomenon is probably the closest in a lot of ways that we've come to this, although there are elements of Father Coughlin and there's a Jacksonian element, you know, as you argue as well. I do think there's something, you know, to be gained from looking at the, you know, recent European experiences with some of this, because as you say, it is a global phenomenon, and some of the techniques and tactics that are being used are being either copied or borrowed from others, and that's important to understand. Not least, and this is maybe an area where I disagree with you, I agree they're trying to weaken the government, but that doesn't mean that they're trying to weaken their own hold on power. Quite the contrary. The weakening of the government actually goes hand in hand with, you know, asserting their control and power over, you know, what in the European context would be called the power ministries. And so you see these loyalty oaths being, you know, imposed, or loyalty tests being imposed on people they're putting into, you know, into senior positions in the intelligence community and in the, you know, government, national security elements of the government, where people are being asked to, it's, you know, Orwellian, you know. You know, the president said yesterday that January 6th, you know, it was the people who were arrested who were being brutalized. And people are now being asked to say, yes, January 6th was an inside job if you want to be in the senior ranks of intelligence or elsewhere.
So that it is, and it's outrageous. It doesn't change the fact that it's the states that are going to run the elections, not the federal government. It doesn't change the fact that you have a federal system. It doesn't change the fact that this guy is almost 80 years old, and he is not, you know, despite kind of joking to get people like us upset, he's not going to run for a third term. I mean, I think I really push back on the Orban and other analogies, because also they point out the things that we see are going on. We don't need the analogies. We don't need the analogies to Orban or Erdogan to see what they're doing. You could just have to read the news. But the point of these analogies is Orban and Erdogan have succeeded. And it's not part of a handbook of what do you do to unspool this. And what you need to be thinking about is how do we unspool this? We know what's going on, and we can get it from our own papers.
Yes, it's a good point. And I mean, actually, one of the other things I wanted to talk about was an article in the Free Press by Rui Tejera, who's written a lot of very good stuff about, you know, how the Democrats ought to think about their problems. This article I had a little bit of a problem with as well. I mean, he basically says, don't fight and die on the hill of USAID. And I kind of get that, because what he's basically saying is, look, this is the kind of political terrain that the Trumpists want you to fight on, because Americans don't like foreign assistance. They think, you know, they have got highly, based on polling data, highly distorted ideas of how much we spend on foreign assistance. You know, it's less than 1% of the federal budget, but they, you know, if you ask people in the blind, how much do you think we spend on, you know, foreign assistance in the federal government, they'll tell you 15% of the budget, 25% of the budget. It's very outlandish. So it's an easy target. There are some domestic constituencies, but there are weak domestic constituencies for this. And I get the point that, fighting for, to preserve USAID is politically probably not the greatest ground for Dems to stand on. However, I don't think that means we shouldn't object to it. And I think there's a way to describe it and discuss it that I think does get at some larger problems. We talked a couple of weeks ago about what, you know, we thought about the first few weeks or the first week or so of Trump. And I said I thought the thing that distinguished it was the lawlessness and the recklessness. Well, this is an area where this is, you know, I'm perfectly happy as, you know, a former ambassador who had aid missions in his embassies to say there are lots of things that, you know, we can talk about and debate about USAID and reforming it. And there's an argument that I've made it myself, that it should be in the State Department, not an independent agency. However, there is a statute on the books passed by the Congress in the late 1990s that says it is an independent agency. And to have Elon Musk swoop in with a bunch of 22-year-old, maladjusted, incel, white supremacist, you know, computer nerds who know nothing about, you know, foreign assistance, and have them, you know, not doing any kind of review, not kind of deciding what needs to be kept, what needs to be closed down, and outside the normal budget process, without any kind of, you know, legal hook on it, you know, violating multiple laws, not just the law that establishes USAID, but the Administrative Procedures Act, the Privacy Act, the Foreign Assistance Act. I think there's plenty to push back on, because I don't think Americans want their government to be run that way.
So I mean, look, I agree with that. By the way, it's not just Roy Teixeira, who I agree with you. I think is a very acute analyst who's been enormously frustrated at trying to get the Democrats to understand what just happened to them. But also Rahm Emanuel, who I think is a very sophisticated politician and internationally minded, who also said this is not the hill to die on. I don't have enough expertise on domestic politics to know how to do that. Look, I think we're you and I are both kind of instinctively revolted at a lot of the foreign policy stuff more than most people. I think we're probably in agreement, unfortunately, is I think this stuff is not going to stop. In some ways, it's going to get worse. And this time around, unlike the last time, I think the damage to the nature of American global leadership will be permanent. But the way, I mean, and here, maybe, you know, you can call me a defeatist if you like. My view is, okay, so what's my job now? Is there any chance that we're going to reverse that? No. Short of not just Trump, you know, having an aneurysm, but J.D. Vance also having an aneurysm. This is what the kind of stuff we're going to do. Vance would be a little bit smoother, but I agree with you. He's in some ways even more dangerous. And he is an isolationist. So we're going to have to think about what exactly is the United States going to do? Because there's a conundrum, and you and I have talked about Michael Beckley's recent pieces in the Foreign Affairs, we'll probably get him on the show. The United States will remain probably prosperous and very powerful. So how will we exert ourselves in the world? But this is the final, I do have a dark view, although I don't know. this is the end of the world order that you and I grew up with, and that you in particular grew up serving. I did in a smaller way. I spent most of my career expounding it, and it's shocking to have it blown up. In this respect, though, by the way, I think that Trump is partly cause and partly manifestation of deeper things. I mean, that's the more I think about this, the more I'm inclined to step back and say, okay, how much of this is the result of having had pretty awful leadership since at least the Reagan era? And how much of this is a result of both parties, including the party that you and I were part of, being willing to give the president unholy amounts of power? You know, and I remember from our time in government, you know, the view that people had of executive power, which made me uneasy then. And Obama ran with that and Biden ran with that. And so now Trump's running with it some more. I mean, for example, I think one of the biggest challenges we're going to face, I have no idea whether we'll meet it or not, is when the wreckage is cleared from this, can we create a system that puts more constraints on the president? Because I think that's really clearly needed. I think it's one of the most essential things that we need to do as we think about our constitutional structure. We need to find a way to rein in executive power.
Well, I think we need to find a way to make the constitutional structure work the way it was intended to work, right? Which is that the founders, when they designed the government and then explicated it in the Federalist Papers, did not anticipate the rise of political parties. They anticipated faction, but they didn't anticipate political parties. They certainly didn't anticipate the kind of polarized political situation we have, although they dealt with something close to it very early on in the Republic, as we know from our discussion with Lindsay Chervinsky. But what they counted on was, and what got them through that period, was people's institutional attachments triumphing over partisanship at some level. And in other words, the Congress acted to offset powers of the executive, or, you know, rein them in. And that has been true more or less, you know, throughout our government's history. And right now we have a Congress, and you could make the argument, I think, as you have been making, that Congress over a long period of time has been yielding power to the executive. But we now have a Congress that is like willingly giving up its power, even though they know it's being taken away and they kind of know it's not right.
Yeah, I agree with that. Look, I think but it's true, the founders also thought that there were other things that would keep the United States going. Part of it was simply its great extent. You know, one of the big arguments that they have to make is, I mean, when everybody thinks of democracy in 1776, they think, oh, Greek city-states, those were really unstable.
Tiny, yeah.
Or they think, well, democracy, yeah, of course it can work if it is a city state, as unstable as they are. And part of the genius of the argument was that, no, actually, you know, you can create a republic which will be, and they called it an empire. And that actually the extent of it and the variety of the people in it and all that would help. So let me shift things a little bit. And this is, I'm walking on thin ice here, but have you had any of those conversations which begin with somebody saying, look, I really hate Trump, but?
No, I have not had any of those conversations.
Well,
but I'm sure you have, so do tell.
you run in more close-minded circles than I do.
I'm absolutely sure of it.
Yeah, well, I have had some. And they are over things like the end of DEI, which I think is actually, you know, I'm signed up for that too. I mean, having seen up close how those bureaucracies functioned in the academic world, The kind of frontal assault on identity politics. That's fine with me. I will give the devil his due. I think on Gaza, of course, he characteristically blew himself up, but I think he did actually get a deal which brought a few of the Israeli hostages back, actually more by threatening Netanyahu than Hamas, because he doesn't really have anything to threaten Hamas with. And you can even say that his utterly outlandish, wrongheaded, inhumane, immoral, illegal
war crime
statement that, well, war crime, okay, take out your thesaurus, I'll mash it against mine. He's at least recognizing the magnitude of the problem that you have in Gaza, which is, as you and I have discussed, having seen that firsthand, it is devastated. It's interesting that he said that economic sanctions on Russia are at 3 out of 10 in intensity. And, this is just a little thing in the clutching and straws department. We just flew a rivet joint aircraft about 140 kilometers from Crimea. So rivet joint is a manned aircraft. It's our premium signals intelligence collector. It's usually escorted by fighter jets. And I may be mistaken, but I don't think we've done that since the invasion. The Biden administration was, they at one point, I think they even pulled back some of the unmanned systems that we've been flying in Crimea. To have done that, I suspect that that's trying to muscle them a bit. In any case, I actually, I've never thought that he was simply going to dump Ukraine. I think he may be some kind of crazy, he may have in mind some crazy deal with, lithium and, rare earths and stuff like that. But, he's being, so far he's been better on that than I would have expected. I mean, again, in the I loathe Trump, but department, I don't know if you saw this article by our mutual friend Richard Danzig in the Washington Post. So this is former Secretary of the Navy in the Clinton administration. I think it was Clinton administration. Saying, actually wouldn't mind if those Doge people would, tackle the Pentagon acquisition system. So now, of course, I should just explain to our listeners that my personal view is that those whom the gods would make mad, they first get interested in reforming the Defense Department's acquisition system. But I know it's a subject that's near and dear to your heart, Eric. So perhaps you could hold forth on that one.
So, well, let me start at the end there about Richard's article in the Post about, Doge getting into the interstices of the Pentagon and reforming the much deservedly maligned procurement system. So, first, Richard's a very smart guy and very thoughtful. And I agree that, if there is one area where it would be helpful, to reform the system, it is in, a Pentagon procurement. In fact, that is the gravamen of a lot of the recommendations we made in the National Defense Strategy Commission that I co-chaired with Jane Harman. But I worry, though, that about a couple of things. One is, the president said the other day that, Doge is going to tackle DOD. And both he and Secretary Hegseth have said there's hundreds of billions of dollars they're going to find in waste. Well, having looked at this, very carefully, not only in this commission, but in its three predecessors, and we had in one of the three predecessor commissions all the really, expert folks who've looked at this and who think there is lots of money to be gained by reforming different elements of the Pentagon. The highest number we could get from any of them about, okay, what's the order of magnitude of savings you're talking about here, it was $150 billion over 10 years.
Yeah, which is not what they're talking about.
It's not what they're talking about. And it's not enough to, you know, do what we need to do as a nation. You know, even if you took all those savings, $15 billion a year, and, you know, plowed them back into the building, you know, to buy the kinds of things we would like to see them buy, you know, et cetera. And that would be if you were doing a good faith effort. You know, I don't have much confidence that, you know, Elon, who has, you know, inveighed against the F-35, for instance, you know, look, the F-35 is an aircraft that's got its limits. On the other hand, the Israelis have just proven how valuable an aircraft that is, because it was the, you know, lead element in the very successful raid they launched after the October Iranian missile attack on Israel. So, you know, I'm afraid he'll go after a lot of the wrong things. I mean, one of the reasons they'll go after F-35 is because there's a big bucket of money there for procurement of F-35, because it's $110 million a copy. And so they'll, instead of saying, look, what we need to do is augment, you know, F-35 with a lot of cheaper, attritable systems, as the Air Force is trying to do.
Which is happening. I mean, a lot of those programs are
right
there.
So that's one thing. But let me just finish on that, because the other element of this is that you can't break the system while you're trying to, you know, reform it. I mean, I think that is a very bad, you know, approach to doing this. And that's what, you know, Elon's approach is. And then finally, the man is massively conflicted. I mean, he's got, you know, billions of dollars in SpaceX contracts with elements of the Department of Defense and the intelligence community. How is that not going to end up being a, you know, conflict of interest that is, you know, which only he can resolve, according to the White House? I'll get back to you on you know, the statesmanship in Gaza and Ukraine in a minute, but go ahead.
No, I guess what, you know, what struck me about the piece, as you say, Richard is a very smart, very thoughtful guy. There's no question where his heart is. He's a sort of a center Democrat. And it's an echo of something that I heard the first time that Trump ran in 2015 from a very sophisticated professional I knew, who was a doctor, not in our world. So, well, you know, maybe it's about time that somebody shook things up. And you know, it is curious that, I mean, in a way that was, I mean, Richard wrote a much more sophisticated version of that argument. But there was an argument there that, you know, things really need shaking up. And I think that is part of what is carrying Trump along, that an enormous number of people want to see things shaken up. And, you know, as I was saying, you know, I think it behooves us to understand, well, what did they want to have shaken up and why? Somebody else who wrote, I thought, a very good piece about this was Tyler Cowen, this, you know, very interesting polymath at George Mason, who said that he thinks that, you know, what Trump really cracked was that this is basically about a cultural conflict, and that so many of the things he does are in a way sending signals about sort of a pretty large and deep culture war over a whole range of issues. And that's what people like about him. And that's the source of his appeal. You know, I'm sure there's more to it than that, but I thought that there's a lot to be said for that interpretation. I do want to get us to talk about foreign policy, though, because, I mean, here, in some ways, I am baffled. You know, like on Gaza, for example, I think it's indisputable. He recognizes the magnitude of the problem. Gaza is a complete and total wreck. Two-state solution is really not in the cards anytime in the foreseeable future. But then he has a completely crazy idea. We're going to move all the Gazans out to Saudi Arabia or Puntland or Egypt or Jordan, and we're going to redevelop it. And it is like, you know, the lunacy of his ideas about Greenland, about Panama, about Canada. And it's, they're so crazy that they're self-destructive at a certain level. At least that's how it seems to me. And so I find it hard to understand what's going on there. I mean, because it, at first I thought, okay, this is just him sort of flim-flamming people, distracting them, getting them off balance, trolling them. But now there's a piece of me that's thinking, no, he actually may be serious about some of this. What's your view?
So my experience with, you know, elected, you know, senior officials, presidents, vice presidents, et cetera, is that when they get there, they don't change, you know, who they are. They become more of what they've always been. And in Trump's case, the man's formative experiences have been as a real estate developer, and he sees the world through that lens. And it's location, location, location. And I think he's dead serious about all of this. You know, I've thought that since the beginning. This is, as Justin Trudeau has, you know, said, you know, on a, you know, hot mic privately, he thought, Trump's serious about this. He thinks, you know, Canada should become the 51st state. And Trump reiterated it to Bret Baier last night in his, pre-Super Bowl interview. Same with Greenland. And I think now with Gaza, I mean, it is kind of, crazy. I mean, because his staff are telling everybody, well, we're not going to spend any American money on this or put boots on the ground. But he's saying we're going to buy it and own it and, you know, then rebuild it. And he says, well, I haven't decided whether I'm going to put boots on the ground. Well, if he actually bought it, which, I mean, I don't even know how you would do that, but he would have to put boots on the ground because there's no other way to secure it. So, and already I think there are some, you know, ramifications to all this. I'm sure this is all pulsing through jihadist, networks online for recruiting purposes. You know, look, I think he thinks the path to greatness, his path, you know, not only to a Nobel Peace Prize, but to Mount Rushmore, is to, you know, double the size of the United States, the way, you know, Thomas Jefferson did with the Louisiana Purchase. And, I think his staff is going to spend the rest of their 4 years trying to, you know, maneuver this into something where they can actually, you know, find use in it. And yes, as you say, I mean, what he said is about Gaza is, a recognition of how, you know, completely everything else that's been tried there has failed, you know, okay, fair enough. But the people who've been most pleased by this is, you know, the extreme right wing in Israel, who think this is just great because they're committed to removing the Palestinian population, ergo that, you know, no problem after that.
Yeah. No, I agree. How likely do you think it is that he will actually get us into a war?
Well, you mean inadvertently or advertently? I mean, I think actually he is, you know, very disinclined to use military force. And we've seen that in his first term. And you've seen it in the comments he made when he signed the executive order on Iran. You know, he made a point that, he would much prefer to negotiate and have a deal with Iran than to go down any of the military paths. And he's also tweeted or truthed on Truth Social that that the reports that the U.S. and Israel are going to collaborate in bombing Iran into smithereens, as he said, are greatly exaggerated. Now, of course, that that formulation, you know, leaves open the possibility it may be exaggerated, but at least they've been discussions going on. So, you know, it's not a completely happy message for the Supreme Leader, but I think he's very reluctant to do that. What I do think could happen, though, is we could get into a conflict because of misperceptions and miscommunication. I think that is very, you know, there's a huge potential for that. And in particular, I worry that a lot of the back and forth and the tariffs and the alienating of allies and whatnot could come back to roost if Xi Jinping decides he wants to, you know, that he wakes up and decides this is the day he wants to reunify China and bring Taiwan back into the fold.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. And I do think, I have always thought, and maybe I'm just clinging to this, that we will make it through this period, which will be disruptive, which I think will actually yield some positive things, but mainly is quite negative. I mean, if we strengthen our constitutional system, if we kind of escape identity politics, a bunch of other things would be good. But I just think the international wreckage is going to be terrible. It is going to be a real challenge. How do you think about, you know, how does America conduct itself in a world where people really no longer trust our leadership and they no longer give us any kind of moral authority? I mean, now, you know, truth is people have always exaggerated the extent to which, you know, people other than Americans thought of us as a beacon on a hill. But still, we did have a certain moral authority. And this guy is blowing it, and in some ways once and for all, because, you know, the first time around you could say it was an accident, nobody knew. The second time around you can't say any of this is an accident. You know, we clearly knew what we were doing, and we gave him a conclusive victory.
You know, I think that is certainly one, you know, possible world that we may be, you know, moving into. Perhaps the most likely one. On the other hand, you know, you mentioned Michael Beckley, and we do need to get Michael on. I mean, he has been writing for some time about, he wrote a book called Unrivaled, and he's written for some time in a vein that I, you know, wrote about earlier about with regard to U.S., primacy and the way it's being contested now. And he basically argues that, you know, the United States still remains exceptional economically. It still has enormous, you know, sources of power that nobody else has in the international system. It's, you know, ironic that his article appeared at roughly around the same time that Marco Rubio said, oh, you know, we got to get over it. We're not, you know, not living in a unipolar world anymore, which is fair enough. But, you know, Marco makes it sound like we're now back in the 19th century, you know, and it's just competing imperialisms. So I kind of take all that, you know, but, you know, look, one thing that remains the case, I think, our allies, whether in Asia or in Europe, have great difficulty organizing anything themselves.
That is, yes.
We have been the convening power and the organizing power. And I think if we get an and one of the Biden administration's great strengths, actually, and you know, God knows you've heard me criticize them for the last 4 years, but one of their great strengths was, you know, doing a pretty good job of organizing the allies to provide assistance to Ukraine, even if it wasn't enough or fast enough. And we had criticism of that. But also the Asian allies, you know, in terms of AUKUS and the Quad and various other things that trilaterals with Japan and the Republic of Korea. So, you know, we uniquely can provide the organizing framework for all that because of our military and economic global reach. No one else can do it. So, I think if you provide that service again in the future, there's a chance that maybe you bring some. Will never be, you know, all the way back, but you can bring a lot of the sort of authority and, you know, gravitas of the U.S. in the system back, I think.
So let me both agree and disagree. You know, I think it'll be easier in Asia, where I think the Asian states have always had a very transactional, they can deal with the transactional United States. For the Europeans, it's harder. They've got their own set of challenges. But I think, you know, look, one of the minor transgressions, but still a pretty severe transgression of this administration is Trump delights in taking away the security clearances of everybody from Joe Biden to Jake Sullivan to Tony Blinken. He hasn't gotten around to you yet, but I'm sure you're on the list. And it's, you know, at one level, people might say, well, that doesn't really make a difference. Well, actually, for some people, it makes a financial difference because it means you can't sit on, you know, corporate boards that do business with the government. But there's a deeper thing, which is, you know, we were able to navigate our way through World War II up to the very recent past by having a foreign policy, national security elite, which was more or less bipartisan, where people spoke with each other. People were at least superficially polite with each other. You know, we've all been at those kinds of gatherings and we all complain about them. But, you know, at the end of the day, that was a good thing. I find it inconceivable that when the Democrats come back, that there won't be payback. I mean, I would suspect, you know, Mike Waltz should not expect to keep his security clearances one day longer than a Republican administration. And certainly most of the staffers, the undersecretaries, the assistant secretaries, many of whom really are Trumpers through and through, they're going to find out that the wheel turns and they will have made themselves sufficiently unpleasant in a variety of ways that everybody will say, yeah, that's right, you know, strip them of their clearances. Plus, there'll be a whole generation of missing normal Republican foreign policy, national security people. And we both know people who are, say, in their 40s now, who should be in responsible positions in government, getting groomed, you know, for the really big jobs by having an early go for it. Well, that's not happening because, you know, as I said in an earlier article, and as you pointed out, in order to get it into this administration, you have to lie. You have to say that Trump won in 2020 and that January 6th wasn't a insurrectionary riot. So I think in some way, and I, you know, this will sound snooty, but societies need elites. And for sure, if you're talking about something as large and complex as the foreign policy of the United States, you need a cohesive elite where there's certain shared assumptions and there's a certain kind of comity. And, you know, you and I have both experienced it. You know, say somebody like Madeleine Albright was always very gracious to me. Okay. But it really didn't make a difference, I think, that I was a Republican, although she did offer to throw a party if I became a Democrat. But we won't have that. And I guess I feel that's consequential, don't you?
I do. And I think what they've done is very short-sighted. You know, there may well come a time where they're going to want to consult with people about some problems that they've got, where it would be very helpful to them to have a little bit of bipartisan support. And you know, they've just poisoned the well. They've made it impossible for them. I mean, as you know, there are any number of times in the government where you're confronted with these, you know, what one of my former bosses who was a Secretary of Defense said, you know, most of the decisions that come here are, you know, if they get to your level, my level, he said, they're 51, 49, you know, could go either way. You know, they're hard, the hard ones. There are times when you've got to make hard decisions and it may not be clear to people outside the government why you're doing what you're doing. And you need to bring them in and show them, you know, as happened, for instance, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, you know, et cetera. So I think it's very short-sighted. I think it's, you know, bad governance, you know, frankly. I always made sure when I was undersecretary that, you know, for instance, Walt Slocum, who was one of my Democratic predecessors, that he, you know, remained a consultant to the Office of the Secretary of Defense, Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, so we could bring him in and have him talk about stuff when we needed to.
Kennedy made a point of consulting with Eisenhower.
Yeah.
Kissinger and Nixon made a point of keeping Johnson thoroughly briefed on what was going on. It was just understood that that's
right.
That's how you behave.
I wasn't surprised that, you know, Trump, you know, cut Biden off from intelligence briefings. After all, Biden had done that to him, you know, in the aftermath of January 6th. I'm sure on the assumption that Trump was, you know, finished politically. I was surprised to see them do it to Blinken and Jake Sullivan, you know, because that was, to me, is just gratuitous.
Yeah, it's, and now what I can't figure out is whether all this is somehow linked to his sense that he was persecuted over that Russian dossier and that these guys were part of it, or if it's just a kind of a part of a larger plan to really cut off anybody who disagrees with him.
Well, it's a tool he thinks he has, I think, that he can wield, because the president does have broad discretion. I mean, what's ironic about this is, you know, you've got people who have devoted themselves to government service for many, many years, who have been cleared, you know, through the normal process, which is, you know, pretty exacting, having, you know, gone through it myself, you know, many, you know, over the years. And, but now you've got all sorts of people who aren't cleared at all, or just being given clearances willy-nilly, who have connections to Russia through Telegram channels and companies they own and this, that, and the other thing. And these other people are getting their clearances pulled. I mean, it's really appalling, honestly.
Yeah. Well, there'll be plenty to talk about, I'm afraid.
I do want to get back to Ukraine before we wrap up, and we are running short on time. And there was one final issue I wanted to touch on with you. So on Ukraine, we had, while you were vacationing in Spain with your family, we had our SAIS colleague, Eugene Finkel, on talking about his very good book on Russia and Ukraine. I guess I'll repeat something I said, you know, with Eugene about, you know, my kind of sense of kind of where Trump is. And it's informed a little bit by things that I heard last week from people. So my sense is, number one, Trump has been repeatedly briefed by people that Xi Jinping and, but certainly Putin, are trying to play him, and that he needs to be careful not to be played, because I think those people rightly understand that Trump does not like the idea that he's being played by anybody. And that's probably a useful thing. He's also been briefed, I think, extensively on Russia's weaknesses economically. And his comments clearly reflect the fact that he has, internalized that. And that if there's anything he understands, it's leverage. And that, you know, this is something that gives him leverage with Putin. And that's all to the good. He's also internalized what was in a very good op-ed by our friend General Jack Keane and Mark Thiessen of AEI in the Post a couple of weeks ago, which was that, you know, additional aid to Ukraine can and should be provided, collateralized by future access to Ukrainian raw materials, whether it's oil and gas or rare earth minerals, of which Ukraine has, you know, quite a bit. And, you know, that's also been part of Zelensky's victory plan. It's something I think Zelensky talked to him about when they met in the fall. And Zelensky just reiterated it in an interview he gave with Reuters over the weekend. That is all to the good. What I worry about is when you hear, you know, General Kellogg talk about this, it also is mixed in with other things like, first we have to have elections in Ukraine, you know, because they haven't had them because Ukraine's under martial law. And then we can get down to the business of negotiating. And so a lot is going to depend on how these various steps get sequenced. Additional sanctions, elections in Ukraine, ceasefire, negotiations, etc. And I worry a little bit. I'm not sure how well they've thought through the sequencing of all this. And I worry a little bit that there's certainly going to be some in the administration who just want to get rid of this problem. And therefore, their idea is going to be, let's elect a Putin-friendly government in Kyiv, and then, we'll negotiate and problem solved.
Yeah, I think maybe, although my reading of this, for what it's worth, is I think Trump really wants the Nobel Peace Prize. I think he has to be irritated that Obama got it after, was it like 4 days in office or something. And I agree with your assessment of his disliking being played. I think that he thinks the Russians are weak. I think he is aware of how people have always described his relationship to Putin, and he's going to show them that they're wrong. The Russians are weak. They have not been able to make advances. The Ukrainians have actually taken a bit more out of Kursk. There's actually a lot of indications that economically they're in trouble. One thing that's quite interesting is the Russians are putting on this kind of big information blitz to tell everybody that their economy is doing just great. And actually, I was on another TV show with a Russian emigre, so to speak, who was basically trying to say, no, the Russian economy is very strong. And, it doesn't make any sense to me. I do think he's going to go for a big deal. I think it is such an intricate problem in some ways. I don't think any sequencing would, make a huge difference. I do think what's going to happen is he'll try. I think he has a vision of how this thing ends. Basically, ceasefire in place, policed by the Europeans, but with an American guarantee that's sort of in the background, and various other things. I think Putin doesn't want that. I don't know that he's been brought around. So I think actually what we're likely to see is that we muscle the Russians. I think the rivet joint thing was a signal, at least partly, because we really haven't done that in a long time. And it's saying, don't you dare try anything. And I think the sanctions talk was revealing too. So I would not be at all surprised if we ratchet that stuff up. And I don't know whether Putin will back down over those things. Because as imperfect as Donald Trump's grip of the world is, I'm not sure Vladimir Putin's is any better. I mean, I tend to think that the information that he's getting makes him think that he's still winning this war. So I think this is actually headed to some sort of crisis. How it ends, I don't know. Although I think, at the end of the day, it will look something like a ceasefire in place and, security guarantees of some sort, not NATO membership, but a Ukraine that can develop. And look, given where we thought this was going to be, it's unsatisfactory, it's unfair. But given where we thought this was going to be?
Yeah, I mean, I find it hard to believe that Putin is going to relent. I mean, I think he wants to just extirpate Ukraine, and I don't think he's going to accept anything less. But before we close out, I just had to ask you one quick question about that great and good statesman, Donald Trump. Donald Trump has made it clear that we're full up. We can't take any more refugees. We don't need any more immigration, et cetera. But he just signed a executive order about South Africa and said, oh, we will take white South Africans if they want to emigrate because they're being treated so poorly in majority rule South Africa today. And I just throwing that out there and wonder what your take is on that.
First, I think a lot of this is Elon Musk. His father and I think his grandfather actually had some pretty ugly connections and views coming out of right-wing Afrikanerdom. I think, look, there is an issue of sort of how the Afrikaners are surviving in South Africa as it is today. But I think it's another example of self-harm. And it goes back to why, at the end of the day, you know, I don't think this guy is nearly as clever as Orban. Orban is a very smart guy. Orban reads lots of books. I actually met him very early on when he was still supposed to be a good guy. He's a very smart fellow.
I met him while he was transitioning into being a bad guy.
So only one half of the face was covered with scales and one-handed claws. Part of what Trump was able to do was to convince a lot of African Americans that he was better for them and that he wasn't a racist. Now, is this, you know, of itself going to turn things around? No. But it's an example of being kind of reckless about some of this stuff and not thinking through, you know, how if I do A may lead to B and B will probably lead to C and that leads to D and D is not a good thing for me. I just don't think he thinks that way. And therefore, I think a lot of the people around him don't think that way. I think in many ways a more significant thing is his deciding to have a bunch of tariff wars with all kinds of people, which are going to hurt his voters. Or, you know, Elon Musk is going to go charging through and say, oh, we can cut billions and billions and billions from Medicaid.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, where 75 million Americans get their health care.
Yeah. I mean, do I want to put my faith for the future of the great republic on Donald Trump's infinite capacity for self-harm? No. But I think, you know, the worried listeners of Shield of the Republic can take some comfort in the fact that, you know, he really does screw a lot of stuff up. And, you know, as you said, because presidents tend to become more of what they were before, he's going to screw more stuff up. Feel better?
As you say, we range all the way in our opinion on Shield of the Republic from, you know, gloom to doom. And this week, I think we've inclined more, maybe a little bit to the gloom side. So, I think you should take your victories where you can.
Yeah. Okay. I'll deal with that.
That'll have to do it for this episode. We'll be back next week.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.